After the governor of South Dakota signed a law banning almost all abortions in his state, most of the focus of the debate that followed was on ethical and moral issues. But what about the economic implications of anti-abortion laws? Well, joining me now is Ted Joyce, a professor of economics and finance at Baruch College and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's the lead author of a study published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, which examined the impact of the parental notification law in Texas. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to my show today. Hi.
Hello.
Is the Texas parental consent law similar to the consent laws that have been enacted in any number of other states?
It's a notification statute, so it's not a consent statute. There's a little bit of a distinction in which the parents must be notified as opposed to give written consent. So there are two kinds of laws, and we call them in general parental involvement laws. The parents have to be involved. So Texas has a notification statute. And the question, I mean, has there been this?
But what happens? So you notify the parents that your daughter has requested an abortion.
Correct.
But then she could have the abortion even if the parents say, I don't like the idea?
Yes. There's not a restriction, but the parents have to be notified, and the minor has to wait 48 hours afterwards.
Do polls indicate that Americans favor these kinds of laws?
Well, most Americans do, although the recent ballot initiative in California voted it down. California may be a different state from the nation, of course. But so it's not quite clear when faced with a ballot like that how the populace will vote.
Well, there are 35 states that have laws that of varying degrees in this area.
Yes, 35 states have parental involvement laws. I think 9 others have passed them, but they've been enjoined in the courts. So it's a pretty popular statute.
Why'd you focus on Texas?
Well, Texas, it's hard to do these studies. Let me just start off by saying that. What you need is a lot of observations, a lot of events. So the New York Times, for example, in their article, they looked at South Dakota and Idaho, two small states. It's just the numbers just aren't there to really draw any kind of strong conclusions. So Texas was the biggest state to pass one of these statutes, number one. Two, it's very diverse racially, ethnically. That's interesting because you expect to see perhaps differences across race, ethnicity. So there are enough numbers within the race, ethnicity to look at that. Then Texas is surrounded by states that have similar statutes. And what's been a big thing in these laws is that kids tend to go out of state. So if you're in Pennsylvania, you tend to go to New Jersey, et cetera. And so that diminishes the impact of the law because the kids are finding ways around it. We had done a study in South Carolina back in 1990 and looked at the effect of their law, but kids could easily go to North Carolina and Georgia, which they did. So Texas had kind of what we called closed borders for the most part, and that made it difficult for minors to go someplace else. So we thought a law would have more bite in this kind of circumstance.
How does the abortion rate in Texas compare with the national rate?
It's lower.
As a result, do you think?
No. Minors are a pretty small part, maybe 10% of all abortions in the state, so they're not going to change the whole state abortion rate. But Texas tends to be a more conservative state, large Latino population. They have lower abortion rates. So for those reasons, Texas is not like Massachusetts, New York, or California.
And Texas is so socially conservative that most people think that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, Texas will then immediately ban abortion.
That's what I've heard, yes.
So do you think that the results would have been different if you had done the study in a socially moderate state that had a parental notification law?
It's a good question. I mean, Massachusetts passed a law back in 1984, and one of the early studies that was done showed that minors left the states in droves. So the number of abortions among minors performed in Massachusetts fell 43% after the law. But if you followed the kids to Connecticut, to Rhode Island, to New Hampshire, basically the law had no effect. So it's important that there be outlets. If there aren't outlets, if the world is closed, then the laws can have bite.
Well, do you think that the law in Texas is effective? Or is having the kind of effect that the lawmakers had hoped for?
Yes. If you are out to decrease the number of abortions among teens or minors in the state, then the law achieved that purpose, yes. I think it was interesting. My brother emailed me and said, you did a study in which both sides of the debate grabbed something and were pleased. So that was an interesting kind of insight.
But you also say that you think the laws had more of an effect on 16 and 17-year-olds than on 15-year-olds. Why is that?
Well, there's survey evidence done in clinics looking at asking minors who are getting contraceptive services or actually asking minors who are waiting for an abortion, whether their parents know about their being there. And the younger you go, the more likely the parents are to know. So our hypothesis was the law is going to have bigger bite the older the minor, because these kids are less likely to involve their parents and may get in trouble by delaying the termination too late, get into 4, 5, 6 months, and then have to carry to term.
Well, what about 17-year-olds who turned 18 during their pregnancy? Were they more likely to get abortions after they no longer needed the consent?
Well, I should probably explain what we did here. This was what made our study different, is that we were able to get kids' age at the point of conception. What's usually done in these studies is this. You look at 17-year-olds before and after the law. You look at their abortion rates. You look at a comparison group, which is 18-year-olds. You look before and after the law. You use the 18-year-olds as a kind of like what we call counterfactual. In other words, the change in abortions among the 18-year-olds who are unaffected by the law is a good estimation, you think, of what would have happened to the 17-year-olds if there had not been a law. So 18-year-olds, your comparison group. Well, the problem with this is that 3/4 of 17-year-olds who conceive as a 17-year-old end up giving a birth as an 18-year-old. So if you use 18-year-olds as your comparison group, the comparison's getting contaminated, because these 17-year-olds who have been affected are showing up as 18-year-olds. So it dawned on us one day that this was really, this could be kind of why people have missed the boat in some of these studies. So we went back and got the data, and we got the kids' exact date of birth. And with that, we were able to date them from the point of conception. And so we could sort out those 18-year-olds who conceived as 17-year-olds, were affected by the law, but end up giving birth as an 18-year-old, from the 18-year-olds who conceived as 18-year-olds and gave birth as 18-year-olds. So that was actually an important, maybe it's too esoteric, but that was actually an important point of the study.
My guest is Ted Joyce, a professor of economics and finance at Baruch College. He's also the academic director of the Baruch Mount Sinai MBA program in healthcare administration. And we are talking about the impact of parental notification on abortion rates, among other things. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Last week, the New York Times released its own analysis of whether parental notification laws in 6 states had influenced the abortion rate among teens, and they concluded there was no real impact. So how did they come to such a different conclusion?
A couple of reasons. One, their choice of states was they made a decision to only look at states which had passed a law after 1995. So the states they could get data from were, Idaho, Idaho, South Dakota, Virginia, Tennessee, Texas, and Arizona. And so immediately you take Idaho and South Dakota and throw them out. They're just too small. Virginia's problematic because so many kids go to Washington, D.C., that the data from Washington, D.C. is terrible, and a lot of the abortions that occur in D.C. to Virginia residents don't go back to Virginia. So we've always kind of been viewed Virginia as a kind of problematic state to study. Arizona is interesting, potentially, but again, there's Nevada. In Nevada, you can get across the border and you can get a termination in Nevada. There's no law there, and there's no law in New Mexico. So both sides make that a little bit porous. So the big prize was Texas. And if you talk to the reporters, their results for Texas don't differ from ours, in the sense that abortions fell substantially, about 20%. But if you average all the states together, which is the number they reported, they showed a decline of 5% among minors and only, 9% among minors and 5% among 18-year-olds. So the 9%, again, was averaging everybody across those six states, and we just focused on Texas.
In that article, abortion clinic workers said that they saw parents encouraging their daughters to get abortions. Sometimes the daughters didn't want them.
Yeah, I don't have that anecdotal evidence. When we were doing the study in Texas, we had talked a lot with some of the advocates there who kind of counsel kids who are trying to get terminations and don't want to involve their parents. And there's this wonderful organization called Jane's Due Process. Beautiful website, and you can access it easily. And they see over thousands of kids a year in Texas and try to counsel them through the bypass process or to counsel them to talk to their parents, et cetera, et cetera. So it's those groups that have those stories, and they tend to be anecdotal. We got one of the anecdotes, and I can share it with you. One story was that kids were pouring across the border into another state. I don't want to give the state away. And that there was a clinic right across the border. And even though this state had a similar law to Texas, the judge in this area was very sympathetic towards minors. She'd give them the bypass in a day, and the clinic would do the termination. So this was, I said, wow, we have to check this out, because if kids are pouring across the border and we're not measuring them, then we'd see abortions go down when in fact it was one of these border issues again. So we went to the clinic and they cooperated and we abstracted their records, or they abstracted them for us, and we oversaw it. And we counted every abortion in the last 3 years in that state before and after Texas passed its law. And there was no indication whatsoever that there are any minors pouring across the border. So you have to be careful about anecdotes. They sometimes are just that, anecdotes.
Well, I'm assuming it's happened because I've seen it happen where a parent says, no 16-year-old daughter of mine is going to have a child. But I guess there isn't enough of a statistical issue here to make that a point.
Right, that's a fair distinction.
You also said that Texas was a good place to look at because it had a diversity of groups.
Yeah.
What are the differences in terms of race?
Well, again, we relied on survey evidence. Again, you're surveying these minors in clinics or in abortion clinics, and you find that African Americans are more likely to have engaged their parents. So I think the figure was like 75% of the parents of African American minors knew that they were there, either getting contraceptive services or trying to get a termination.
And why do you think that is?
It's a good question. I could only speculate. Maybe it's dangerous to speculate. I don't know if single-family homes, let's say single-parent homes, are more prevalent among African Americans. Mothers very engaged in making sure the child doesn't have a teen pregnancy or something. I don't know. I probably shouldn't go that area. It's not my bailiwick, so let me probably stay out of it.
And you also discovered Hispanic teenagers got fewer abortions than their white counterparts or their Anglo counterparts, and that perhaps is because of religious values, or don't you want to go there either?
Could be. No. I don't do anthropology, and so we were just relying on the survey evidence, which said that Anglos and Latinos were definitely different from African Americans.
Well, so can we assume that the notification laws had its biggest impact on white teens?
Yes, it did.
87% of the counties in Texas don't have abortion providers, so we're still talking about kids having to travel. Most of them would have to get their parents' consent anyway, wouldn't they?
The 87% is an interesting number. It's again, that's the number of counties. Texas has got a lot of counties. If you looked at the proportion of kids that live in a county with a provider, the number is much smaller. So if you go to the big population centers like Houston, Austin, Dallas, et cetera, there are providers. You can go on the web and they're listed right there. You can type in abortion.com and they'll list you the providers right in Texas.
Were you surprised by how much the notification law affected the abortion rate among teenagers?
Yes.
Well, it was in some age groups down by 20%. And one Texas state legislator said that the law was having its desired effect to get parents involved in this significant life decision. But is that necessarily the case? Could you tell whether teenage girls were talking to their parents or just waiting until they began to show their pregnancies and had no choice in the matter?
Well, we can't tell. We didn't do the survey. Doing surveys of abortion are extremely difficult. People are very reluctant to talk about abortions. So we have a couple of national surveys, a National Survey of Family Growth. The estimate is they underreport abortion by about 50%. It's very hard to do surveys, number one. So we tried to look at behavioral changes, and we're much more confident about the comparisons between the older minors as opposed to the younger minors, because the older minors are very similar to our comparison group, which is 18-year-olds. And in that group, we found some very interesting responses. So if you looked at the kids who were 17 years and, let's say, 6 to 8 months when they conceived, all right, these are the kids who conceptually, if they had to, could wait until their 18th birthday to have the termination. And what you found among these kids in that age group was a spike in second trimester terminations. In other words, there was clear evidence to us that the spike happened just at that point. It didn't happen among kids who were 17 years and 3 months. Didn't happen among kids who were 17 years and 10 months. Both those groups, one can just, it's going to turn 18 quickly, doesn't make any difference. The other one, the 17 years and 3 months, can't wait. I mean, they'll be 7 months pregnant and it's gone. So the only in the group who could really wait did we find this spike in second trimester terminations. So it was pretty dramatic evidence to us that these kids were, there was a subgroup of kids that was trying to wait to get over the line, didn't have to involve their parents, and the termination happens to be in the second trimester.
Which should tell something to the Texas lawmakers, shouldn't it?
If you care about those public health issues, yes. If you don't care, if you think the more important issue is a fetus saved or whatever, it wouldn't make any difference.
Have laws like these made it harder for abortion clinics to stay open?
It makes it more costly for compliance, perhaps. They have to be more careful. You've seen a diminution in the number of smaller clinics and solo practitioners, and perhaps even growth in the largest clinics, the family planning Planned Parenthood clinics. They're the ones who are doing, 1,000, 2,000 abortions a year, and they're well established in the major urban areas, and they're not going away.
Well, the South Dakota law was passed, obviously, to create a test case, but these are the kinds of laws that we're seeing pushed through state legislatures by opponents of abortion who didn't think that they could defeat Roe v. Wade on the Supreme Court level just yet.
Right. The strategy has been clearly to kind of make abortions more expensive. That's how economists get involved here. You want to make it difficult to access. You want to make it costly in every way you can. So you go after the providers. You make sure that they can provide emergency surgery procedures or facilities for those kinds of procedures. And so you're going to make it just ratcheted up for everybody involved. So if you're going to access abortion, it's going to cost a lot more than it did in the past. That had been the strategy to date. I think with the changing composition of the U.S. Supreme Court, the anti-abortion forces may be feeling that this may be the time to go for it.
Ted Joyce is a professor of economics and finance at Brooke College and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He's also the academic director of the Brooke Mount Sinai MBA program in healthcare administration. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Professor Ted Joyce of Baruch College. He is the lead author of a study published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, which examined the impact of the parental notification law in Texas. And I mentioned the article last week in the New York Times about parental notification laws. You were quoted in that article, and you mentioned that there were larger trends that are more important than parental involvement laws. Like what?
We've had a remarkable decrease in teen birth rates and teen abortion rates over the last 13 years.
Even before these laws started being passed?
Yes. Starting in 1990, there were laws prior to 1990, of course, but they weren't in as many states as they are now. So these laws have contributed perhaps to this, but there are clearly ongoing trends in greater contraceptive use among teens, perhaps more abstinence, welfare reform. There's a constellation of kind of forces that seem to be impinging on teen fertility that are affecting both birth and abortion rates. We think this law in Texas accelerated the decline in abortions in Texas, but there are very strong ongoing trends even prior to this law.
Economist Stephen Levitt, the author of Freakonomics, a best-selling book, has linked the drop in crime to Roe v. Wade. I guess he could have found a link to dropping abortion rates as well. Do you go along with any of that?
Steve and I are in a academic debate, and so we've both published articles. I've published an article saying that he's way overestimated the impact of Roe v. Wade on crime. Steve has responded. We're going to meet at the University of Rochester March 30th. And they've organized a debate. So I really come down on a different side of the equation. I think Steve has looked at the data differently than I have. And when I look at it, it doesn't stand up. So, again, this sounds he said, she said kind of thing.
But we have seen a drop in the crime rate.
Oh, yes.
Although that may be due to other factors.
Well,
fewer children born. But that, again, might be because of abortions,
I really linked to the crack epidemic. The rise in homicide rates, which is really the best measure of crime, increased dramatically. At some point, 300% among youth, among African American youth. I mean, that's a staggering increase in crime. And so the homicide rate soars from 85 to 91, peaks in 1991, and then starts to decelerate rapidly. It only occurred, the rise was totally driven by individuals less than 25 years of age. So my argument with Steve is that you really have to go look at those cohorts, those younger cohorts, and those age groups to kind of tease out the result. I think the criminologists have the right story. It was this link between crack to guns to gangs that made crime go up. There's a response both by individuals as to the devastation of crack. There's a response by the police. And those forces have helped push it back down, and now it's still going down. I mean, what's the true causal mechanism? I think there's a whole constellation of things going on.
Now, the Texas study is not the first one you've done on these kinds of laws. You studied Mississippi's mandatory delay law in 1997. What restrictions did that law put on abortion?
Well, the Mississippi law came right out of the Casey decision in 1992, and it said that basically the state could impose restrictions on abortion provided they did not cause an undue burden on a woman's right to access abortion. So Mississippi passed a mandatory counseling and delay requirement and went like this. The woman had to come in. She had to receive a counseling session by the doctor as to the risks involved, as to her options should she not want to have the termination. She had to think about it, wait 24 hours, and then reschedule the termination. So again, Mississippi was just trying to make it more expensive to access abortion.
Were the doctors told what they had to say and what they
couldn't
say?
Yes, there's a written text as to the content of the information, the pictures that have to be shown, pictures of the fetus, et cetera. So it's a very...
So it's really a lecture against abortion.
Yes, it's very pronatalist, you'd say, and really against abortion.
And I assume that if there were also people picketing the abortion clinic, then it might have been... a lot of women might have been reluctant to come back the next day.
No, good point. I think they raised the cost in general of like coming, going, getting babysitting. You know, if you traveled from the Delta, that could be a 70, 80 to 100-mile trip. So they knew what they were doing when they passed this law. They wanted to make abortion happen less often, and they did.
By what percentage?
We found about a 12% decrease in abortion rates in Mississippi after the law.
Was there any evidence to suggest that women were traveling to other states to get abortions?
Yes, there were. Women were going to Tennessee. We could follow them to Tennessee because the data was shared between Tennessee and Mississippi. And they were going to Alabama as well. They were going to Louisiana, but Louisiana does not collect that data, so we couldn't really follow them to Louisiana. So we did certain adjustments to kind of take Louisiana into account. But at the end of the day, we're pretty comfortable with that number. Abortion rates fell about 10-12%.
In 1992, when the delay law went into effect, there were 8 abortion providers in Mississippi. Today, there's only 1 abortion clinic, and that probably is going to close. The Mississippi state legislature passed a law banning almost all abortion last week. So have you been surprised by the pace of the movement to push abortion out of that state?
Out of Mississippi, no. Mississippi's been fighting this battle a long time. That one clinic's been there.
And why Mississippi of all states? Is there some confluence of religious feeling, or is it just that there are an awful lot of people in Mississippi who are opposed to abortion? I think if polls are taken around the country, it's a bit more of a mixed message, isn't it?
Yes. Nationally, the polls are mixed, but I think in some of these more southern religious states, perhaps like Mississippi, it certainly is not a favorable procedure. There are no indigenous OBGYNs who perform abortions in Mississippi for years. They fly them in. Seemingly no OBGYN would have that part of their practice because you'd be ostracized. So Mississippi has made it clear this is not a place in which they want terminations done.
It's interesting that Mississippi is one of the poor states in the country, and South Dakota, which just passed a law banning abortion, has 3 of the 10 poorest counties in America. So is this more likely to happen in states where the economy is weak?
I wouldn't generalize like that so far. I think cultural, religious values would be more important than economic values. We could go to other poor states, but, you know, I testified in Kentucky. Kentucky's not a wealthy state either. I haven't looked at it carefully enough, but my first impulse would be it's more cultural than economic.
An Annie E. Casey Foundation study estimated that teenage pregnancy costs us $7 billion annually. Do you know about that study?
I'm not familiar with it, but people do that. Economists do that. They look at the costs of a teen carrying a pregnancy to term as opposed to terminating it.
Well, it's the loss in tax revenues, public assistance, child health care, foster care, involvement with the criminal justice system. They have all been factored in.
Yeah. I mean, those are not simple studies to do, and often they're they're the best estimates we can come to, but they're difficult studies.
Do proponents of parental notification laws acknowledge the possibility that these costs have been added on and may be a reason for some of the places where they are really effective being among the poorest in the country?
Well, the conversation ends pretty quickly. If you think a fetus is a life, then the value of life trumps all, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Has there been increased demand for related social programs since 1992 when the Supreme Court recognized the rights of states to limit abortion?
You couldn't link it to abortion. There are too many other things going on. Welfare reform was much more of a had a much more dramatic impact on social services than did abortion in that sense. So it would be a hard thing to sort out the two of them. And as I think about it empirically, I go, whew, that's a tough study.
Well, teenage mothers are much less likely to graduate from high school, and I would assume that would decrease their earning potential.
Yeah, again, I work with a colleague at Baruch, Sanders Korneman, who did a very important study when he looked at the effect of teenage pregnancy. And we may be overestimating the impact of the pregnancy itself. In other words, he looked at sisters, one sister who had a teenage pregnancy and the other sister who didn't. And basically, neither sister did very well in terms of education or employment. The point being, it really wasn't the pregnancy per se. It was really the family kind of upbringing, culture, poverty, et cetera, that, as usual, seems to trump most things.
My guest is Ted Joyce, professor of economics and finance at Baruch College and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research, the lead author of a study published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine, which examined the impact of parental notification laws in Texas. Now, before Roe v. Wade, New York already had legalized abortion. A few other states had. And they became magnets for people who were seeking abortions. What is the economic impact of something like that? I understand that at one point, Buffalo clinics and hospitals were swamped. They found it impossible to handle the overflow.
Yes. Most often you'd see providers adjust to those kind of overflows pretty quickly. The economic impact, certainly it creates demand for those services in New York. That's replacing demand someplace else. Certainly if we reversed Roe and the scenario became some states like New York had legalized abortion and states like Pennsylvania did not, you would expect to see these flows happen quickly.
Pro-choice advocates say that the people who would be most hurt by the most stringent anti-abortion laws are the poor. So do you go along with that?
Sure. Is that surprising? It would be most expensive for them to go, to arrange the hotels, to travel. There have been studies that showing that even when Medicaid is cut off to poor women, that Medicaid for funding of abortion in North Carolina, for example, that they would have a termination as opposed to round up to $300. So people who are poor are very price sensitive, and you would expect to see the people most likely to travel would be middle class parents taking their teenage daughters, et cetera. So yes, that's how I think it would shape out.
And in December, New York Magazine ran a story about how New York is becoming the abortion capital, at least of the East Coast. I guess California cities are the abortion capitals of the West Coast. I guess you visit Disneyland at the same time. But I'm not sure what this says about the future and what your study finally tells us about the future.
Well, I think the study says that these laws matter because you make it more costly to access a service. And if we go all the way to banning abortions and let the states decide for themselves, you'll make it that much more costly. It'll still be legal in New York and California, and people will travel. But again, because of the expense, you'll see a lot fewer abortions.
And on the other hand, for a city like New York, is this a potential economic boom? I mean, it sounds cynical, but it means an awful lot of people coming here, hotel rooms filling up.
The New York Magazine article referred to talked about a kind of underground railroad in which women were basically housing other women who were coming to seek later terminations and helping them through the process. Those kinds of networks may develop. But again, if you saw an increase, if we go back to 1970, let's say there were 100,000 abortions to out-of-state women coming to New York. If that number holds up in 2010, for example, and we see another 100,000 women come to New York, New York can handle 100,000 people for a day or two.
All the polls indicate that the majority of Americans want abortion services available on some level. So why have so many states been able to limit them?
I think the activists...
I'm looking at South Dakota, the state that gave us George McGovern and Tom Daschle, among other liberal politicians. And now it looks like everybody in politics in South Dakota is ready to ban abortion.
Yeah, I'm not a political analyst in that sense, but if you think, take a presidential election, what percent of the electorate votes? Let's say it's 55-60%, which is really good. Take a state election, it's probably even less. Let's say it's down to 50% vote. So of that 50%, you can have a very active, very vocal group, I think can have a great impact on politicians and legislatures on these issues. And so they are organized.
Is this an area that many economists are getting involved in?
Economic demography has been a subfield for a long time, and abortion and fertility are subfields of that larger branch. So economists are looking at the impact of abortion. I just got a paper from a colleague today from Wellesley College, Phil Levine. He just wrote a book on abortion last year. So Steve Levitt's book in Freakonomics obviously is a huge bestseller, and a major chapter there is Roe v. Wade's impact on crime. So yes, economists have been in this area for a while because it is a service. It's one of the most common surgical services in the country. So for that reason alone, you're going to look at it, and yet its impact may be greater. So again, it's attracted a lot of academic attention.
From some of your responses, I've gotten the feeling that you feel that when you do these kinds of studies, you can interpret them in many different ways and often in ways that reflect your own opinions about something like abortion.
Well, I don't want to concede that I bring my priors to every
study. I wasn't saying you.
That's okay.
No, in fact, you sound like you were being very careful, but when we were talking about the New York Times piece and when we were talking about Steve Levitt, for example, you were suggesting that.
Well, no, I don't think either one of those is a reporter from the Times that had a dog in the fight, so to speak. I think Steve's argument is, and I'm not sure if he's – I don't think he's pro-choice at all. I think his argument was this is a huge phenomenon, 1.5 million abortions in 1980 when it reached its peak, for example. Something – there has to be an impact to this kind of selection mechanism, so to speak. So Steve saw big numbers and went looking. The New York Times, I think, raised the question because it's front and center in the national debate and tried to look at a subset of states. So I think people have tried to be honest about it. People want to say statistics lie. I want more to say that social science is an imperfect process. It's not like a randomized clinical trial here. So it takes a whole slew of studies going over sometimes the same data before we get convinced that anyone's got the right answer. And I just think that's how science goes forward, at least in the social sciences.
Do you ever talk to the doctors involved?
I do talk to OBGYNs, not a lot. I did talk to the head of the clinic in Mississippi, Susan Hill, and try to get a sense of what their issues are, how they deal with these laws, how costly these laws are to respond to. Again, they're all very good. Susan Hill runs the private clinic. She's a very good businesswoman, and she works really hard to kind of keep the cost of abortion down in spite of having to add all these other kinds of services. So you do get good information about from these practitioners.
And she not only has to add all of those kinds of information like the lectures and the like, but also security.
Yes.
And that is there are a lot of hidden costs to these things.
Yes, absolutely. They've even, I think Mississippi is now requiring they have certain width of the hallways so they can bring gurneys down. I mean, and that would mean she'd have to restructure the whole building. So they know what they're doing, the anti-abortion forces, in the sense of making it more costly for both the provider and the patient to access these services. It's a strategy that's worked.
Ted Joyce is the lead researcher, lead author in an article in the New England Journal of Medicine on the costs of parental notification laws. on abortion. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.